Hey writers, I'm Jenny Nash, founder and CEO of Author Accelerator. It's back to school time, which means it's a great time to start training to become a book coach. By this time next year, you could be certified and out there helping writers bring their books to life, even if you're not a published author yourself. Take our quiz, The 10 Characteristics of a Great Book Coach, to find out if you have what it takes to become a great book coach. Visit bookcoaches.com/characteristics-quiz. That's the clunkiest URL ever, so let me say it again. bookcoaches.com/characteristics-quiz. We'll also put it in the show notes so you know you're going to the right place.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, this is Jess, and welcome to the hashtag AmWriting podcast. This podcast is the podcast about getting all the work done, getting all the writing, getting all the publishing, getting all the marketing, getting all the querying, getting all the proposal work, all of that stuff done. We talk about long things, short things, proposals, queries, edits, all of the stuff. More than anything else, though, this is the podcast about getting the work done. I'm Jess Leahy. I am the author of the New York Times bestselling The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation, and I have written for The Atlantic. I have written for The Washington Post and had a column at The New York Times for 3 years called The Parent-Teacher Conference. Today, it's just me. I am going to answer some questions that have arrived either through the amwritingpodcast@gmail.com email or DMs that came in to me, or questions that people have asked in our hashtag AmWriting Facebook group, which you should absolutely join. It is a very positive place. We don't allow any mean comments in there. We have a moderator. So here's some of the stuff that appeared in that group over the last, and in our email boxes over the last, month or so. So number one, yay, my book came out. Yay! And I got my first speaking inquiry. How do I know what to ask for? Like, I'm out in the dark here. I've never done this before. Well, this was a question that I had to have answered for me way back when I got my first speaking event invitation. Oddly enough, it was for an article I wrote on coming-of-age rituals for families that don't have sort of a religious tradition. I was thinking about bar and bat mitzvah and that kind of stuff. And we just, we did not raise our children in a religion. So we really just don't have that. We don't have a cultural tradition around it either. So I had written a piece for my column over at the New York Times about that and about some of the tasks that we wanted my kid, my oldest, to learn over the summer before his 13th birthday, I think. It was just fun. It was just some basic things that I thought that he could do. Anyway, so I got invited by a Jewish Education Foundation to talk about, you know, what's happening with coming of age ceremonies. And of course, I had no knowledge base really within the Jewish tradition of, I've attended bar and bat mitzvahs and all of that sort of thing, but I'm not Jewish myself. And they were really sweet. They asked me based on just this article I had written for the New York Times. And so I went to Lori Abkemeyer, who was not my agent at the time. Those of you who have been listening for a long time know that I chased Lori Abkemeyer for 10 years, a long time. I really, really wanted her to be my agent. I knew that she needed to be my agent. Maybe it wasn't that long, but it was very close to that. And it just, we never sort of saw eye to eye on a project. And when we finally did, it was The Gift of Failure. And I signed with her and everything was great. But this is before I ever signed with her and I didn't know who else to ask. So she said, look, for a first time keynote, ask $5,000, and the worst they can do is say no. They reached out, they want you, so, you know, you lose nothing. And I was really scared of that. Oh, but if you ask too much, are they going to be insulted and walk away? And, you know, after doing this for a while, you have to remember, they came to me. They want me there. This isn't, you know, this wasn't like a broad shotgun approach to, you know, going to like 26 different people and getting bids. They wanted me. So value your time. They were unclear about that. They didn't give me any information about their budget, which of course you're not likely to get, but I'm going to talk about that too. So I asked the $5,000 and they said, we can't afford that. Here's what we can afford. And I think I got, I think it was something like $2,000, and they put me up in like the pod, one of those pod hotels in New York. And I can't remember if they paid for my travel or not, but it was $2,000 and I was super excited. It was my first keynote, super excited. And of course you want to ask for testimonials. You want to gather testimonials from the beginning. So I wanted to make it as great of an experience as I possibly could. So I practiced and practiced. And of course, when I got there, as often happens, my content changed. Once I had, I sat down at a table with a whole bunch of rabbis, and my content changed while I was listening to the other presenters and while I was talking to the rabbis. So anyway, so that's a good starting place for a keynote. $5,000 is a great place to start. It's sort of what anyone would expect for an early in career keynote. Okay, number two. Someone asked me to provide video content for a conference slash summit slash virtual event. What should I charge? Well, this is a slightly more complicated thing because this happens quite a bit, actually. So let's say, for example, I did a video for Salesforce. It was a Q&A, the company Salesforce. And they wanted to be able to keep that video in perpetuity as their own and do whatever they wanted with it. Now, for a Q&A, I'm not that worried about sort of the giving the milk away and not, you know, why would someone come to one of my events if they can just pull up a video off the internet? Well, that's not what this was. This was very specific to Salesforce and their customers. So I didn't have to worry about that as much. But let's say someone wanted to hire me and they wanted video, and they wanted video of like my talk that I give a lot. Well, I would be really hesitant to give that away for less than a fair amount of money, because now you have to assume it's your speaking fee plus, you know, the chance that you're going to lose opportunities based on that video being out there, and you're giving them something that they're going to own. So sometimes that's going to be obviously a flat fee from the beginning, but I keep that in mind. So for example, if I were to get hired to speak, one of the clauses in my contract is always, you can't film my my presentation unless you have my permission. And often I'll give my permission because they want to keep it for 30 days or 90 days behind a password or only with a registration link or somehow not searchable on the internet as a whole. And that's great. I love that, because often people who didn't come to the original talk will watch the video afterwards. But what we're talking about here is something different. We're talking about something that someone will keep forever. So if you were going to ask, let's say, for example, $5,000 for that talk, I would ask a lot more. I might even double it and say $10,000. So especially if they're charging for that content. And excuse me, I'm home alone and Moby is barking in the other room. Just enjoy the background weirdness. Keep in mind that you're giving away your value to a lot of audiences. And again, if that's something that's openly, if someone could just Google Just Leahy Gift of Failure talk, you know, why would they pay to bring me there? And why would they just not put it up on a projector and project it on the wall? Okay, the next question, question number three. What is all this about affiliate codes and revenue sharing for conferences? Okay, for some of you may know that it's been a thing in the past, I don't know, 5 years or so, for people to hold like online virtual summits, like and especially in the parenting space or in the recovery space. But parenting space are the ones that I get invited to a lot. So it's bringing a bunch of people together, a bunch of experts together on a variety of topics for an online virtual summit. I love it. Love the idea, love the premise, all that sort of stuff. Often, however, in order to hire you for one of those things, and by the way, these do not pay. So occasionally, someone will get like a small honorarium, but more often than not, you get reimbursed through this thing called like affiliate code sharing or coupon sharing or registration sharing or, you know, anyway, it's essentially I would be expected to use my platform, my email lists in order to, you know, gather up as many people and get them enrolled in the class for a fee. And then I would would get part of that back. I would get this affiliate sort of amount of money through my affiliate link that I'm using to get people to register. The other thing that, and I'm not a fan, it's a lot to keep track of. And anyway, it's some places make it super easy. If this is a thing you want to do, then great, fantastic. It can be really great. If you're willing to go to a lot of work to get people to sign up for something according with your affiliate code, then you can make a fair amount of money. The other requirement that some of these places will have, some people will have for these sort of virtual summits, is there's an expectation, by the way, look at the contract very carefully, there's an expectation that you will promote as well, that you will promote to your email list, that you will promote on social media channels, that you will use, you know, some of their content to promote these things. And if you want to use your email list for that kind of thing, that's up to you. I don't. I do not. I'm very protective of the emails that I send out. It's a huge act of trust to give me your email address. And so I try to only give you things that you might be really interested in. Now, if that's being interested in a virtual parenting summit, because that's maybe how someone found you or signed up for you in the first place, have at it. But just be really careful of those kind of contracts. So I make it really clear that I will not participate in the thing where I email all of my my very special and precious email list. And often people will be like, okay, well, you don't have to do that part of it. So anyway, that's clearing up what the affiliate link or revenue sharing for some virtual summits are. All right, number four, what reference books would you recommend for writing nonfiction? There's a lot of great books out there for writing fiction, and someone asked if I could share my suggestions for when you're writing fiction. And I published a picture on social media of my favorite books for that. And I have a lot. So I made a pile and put those up on my social media, actually, so that you could see for yourself what those books are. But very briefly, they are, and I'm looking for the picture of it so that I can tell you what they are. They are Ann Patchett's This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. It's just an inspirational book about writing, no matter how you slice it. There's The Art of Memoir by Mary Carr. She's brilliant, and you know, that's always a solid choice. Any Mary Carr, if you're trying to study the craft of memoir writing. There's a book called Good Prose by Tracy Kidder and Richard Todd. Tracy Kidder is one of my very favorite nonfiction writers, starting way back when with the book House. There's Jenny Nash's Blueprint for a Book, specifically on memoir, was the one I was referring to here. A book called You Can't Make This Stuff Up by Lee Gutkind. Lee Gutkind is the founder of Creative Nonfiction, one of my very favorite magazines in the world. And then finally, a book called On Good Authority by Anna David. Anna David puts out some really, really great content, and her book On Good Authority is no exception. All right, so next up we have the question. Let's see. It's time to ask for blurbs for my book. How do I figure out who should blurb my book? And then there's a second question. There's a second and a third question. How do I figure out who should blurb? You know, reach for the stars. If you're writing, for example, for me, I was writing in the parenting/education space, so I'm going to look for the luminaries in that area, nonfiction luminaries. Mm-hmm. If you're writing creative nonfiction, mm-hmm. If I was writing sort of a memoir-y creative nonfiction, then I would reach out to other writers who write that kind of thing, like, you know, a Mary Laura Philpott, for example, or a Jenny Lawson, that kind of person. If, you know who the luminaries are in your field, and so go crazy. Yes, this is extremely nauseating and scary, and especially when you figure that these people are going to be reading a version of your book that's barely been copy edited. It's, you know, it's very rough. The galley form is very rough. And, you know, we get used to that. I'm used to reading galleys, and I don't get caught up on the mistakes because I know that the author is going to find them and the editor is going to find them. So reach for the stars. And then this is like, you know, applying to colleges. Have like your reach person and have your you know, your people you think you can get, and then have a couple safeties. The nice thing about having the reach people and having the some safeties and having some people in the middle is that there's also going to be people who are just going to say no based on their schedule. I had one of my reach people just was in the finishing phases of one of her books and just couldn't do it. I got to her through her assistant and through a friend of a friend. And that, you know, I get it. That's, you know, a sort of a spot where I'm in right now. I'm trying to cut down on my schedule as well. How do I ask? How do I ask for a blurb? You essentially say, I'm a huge fan of your work. I used your book, for example, as one of those book dissections. You know, if I was reaching out to someone that I had used sort of as a model for the tone I was looking for in my book, I really enjoy your work. I really respect what you do. I would be so honored if you would be willing to read this for a blurb. Be clear, because I have received lots of asks to read books, and then it's on me to say, I'm sorry, am I reading this to blurb the book, or am I reading this just to read it because you would like me to have laid eyes on it before the pub date? And then that makes, and it's embarrassing sometimes because, you know, you don't want to be like, oh, you've asked me to blurb. Of course you would ask me to blurb because I'm so wonderful. It can be really tricky, but I had to do it just recently and it turns out they were asking me to blurb. They were just being kind of shy about it. My response, and this is just me, my response is always, I promise to read with an eye to blurbing, but I can never promise to blurb until I have read the book because, you know, I don't know if this is going to be any good. And I do look at your sources and I do look at sort of, you know, are you, anyway, I'm looking at a lot of things in order to figure out whether or not I want to blurb a book. And so, I need to know if that's why I'm reading it. So, and then you have to ask for a deadline. Make sure you ask for a deadline or you offer a deadline. You know, your editor will often say, you know, we really need to have all the blurbs in by X date. And sometimes that can be pushed, and a lot of authors know that. But make it really clear that there is a date. If you need to fudge it by bringing it, you know, making it earlier so that you can remind them close to and close to the date. And if they say, oh no, I'm stuck, I'm on the road for the next 2 weeks, I can't possibly, you can say, okay, well, I can give you an extra week. It's sort of a nice cushion of cushion there. Someone also asked, can I ask someone to blurb who's quoted in my book? Okay, this is going to be, there's going to be differing answers to this. So, for example, I may have mentioned Madeline Levine in my book. Madeline Levine was also represented. My editor was also Madeline Levine's editor. Who knows that information? How many people are going to know that Madeline Levine and I shared an editor? But I could have asked Madeline Levine, but I didn't, essentially because it was too close. It was too incestuous because of the link through my editor. For some people, that would never have mattered. On the other hand, you know, there were very specifically people that I mentioned in my book that I did not ask to blurb because it looks too echo chambery, right? You know, if I ask someone I've quoted heavily in the book, like, for example, Wendy Grolnick, it's in her best interest to say something good because it promotes her work. So I avoided asking Wendy Grolnick to blurb the book. I did get, I asked someone that I respected to blurb my book, and that person got angry that they weren't in my book. And so that sort of, that relationship went down the toilet. Anyway, so it's really a tricky thing to ask for blurbs, but you just need to, you know, take a deep breath and do it and be very polite and be respectful. You're going to get some no's, and that's cool. You can have, and there's also, on the other side of that argument about whether or not you should ask people who are in the book to blurb it, I know plenty of people who do. So, you know, this is sort of a style difference. Now, if you, your publicist or your editor, if they have a better way to get to this person, they can ask. I just happen to think that it's better if I, the author, ask for the blurbs. It's more personal, right? And, you know, I'm less likely to say yes to an editor or publicist than I would to the actual author, although I have done both. The other thing you might want to think about if you're going to say no, like let's say you don't like a book, be really careful in responding to that publicist or that author. just, it's really hard to put out a book. As you know, we don't tend to slam books here. But if you really don't like a book and you don't think you're the right person to blurb it, then just say, I'm not the right person to blurb this book. I'm really sorry. Or if you have real serious issues with the book and you think it could be helpful, keep in mind this book is already locked down. So if you say something or make criticisms, there's not much time to change them. And it's so just, you know, there's those moments when you realize I could give feedback on this, but I don't know that it's going to be helpful because there's nothing the author can do at this point. Okay. If I quote myself in my own book, is that plagiarism? what if I really need to use that quote? How do I do it? This was a question that came into the Facebook group, the hashtag MWriting Facebook group. And my answer was, if I need to quote myself, I'll say something like, as I wrote in an article in The Atlantic in December 2024, or as I wrote in The Atlantic, or as I wrote in The Washington Post. And then I quote myself. I mean, there's the one side of the argument is you can't plagiarize yourself, but there are plenty of authors who have gotten in trouble for mining their own content for books without saying that this was previously published in an article. So be careful. I would be clear. And then I would also cite that article in the endnotes/footnotes or whatever format is being used. Let's see. Number 7, I've been asked to speak, but I'm freaked out by my time slot or some other challenge to the audience members. How do I get people to stay and listen? This was a really sweet question I got. The person had been scheduled to speak in the afternoon and was worried about people leaving during lunch. It was on a Friday. You know, I'm faced with this all the time. I gave a talk to high school students where I was the only thing between them and a 3-day weekend. It's a nightmare. Like holding a high school kid's attention, middle school and high school kids' attention in the last hour before a 3-day weekend, there is no worse time slot, honestly. If you're doing like a professional conference and you're the last session of the day, that also stinks because people are going to take off early. If you can advocate for yourself with the timing, get yourself switched to the morning. Just try that first. If you have to do it, the thing I told this person that emailed me about it was to make it really clear that what you're going to be offering are practical suggestions, takeaways. This is not like just about the research. This is about what we as, for example, teachers, parents, mental health professionals can do to help. And here's an example of some of the takeaways. You know, you don't want to give away everything, but give people a peek into why this is going to be so useful for them. I don't want to say too much without giving this person away on what the topic was, but the more takeaways you can offer, the more you make it clear that your stuff is going to be practical. The other thing I suggested, and I don't know how easily someone can do this in the marketing materials or in the description, is to cop to it. Look, this is at the end of the day. Everyone's going to be tired. We're going to have some fun. There will be some humor. I might bring snacks, whatever it is to try to lure people to come in at the end of the day. I apologize to this person for her terrible placement at the end of the day because there just aren't a lot of ways to make up for the fact that it stinks. When I do speaking events, I try not to schedule them on Monday. People forget about things over the weekend and there's a rough entry on Monday. I also don't do speaking events on Friday night just for this particular reason. People have other things they want to do. And it's hard to get people to come and listen to speaking events. And people always want to peel out early, especially if they're traveling somewhere. If a lot of people are traveling to a conference, for example, the last day in the afternoon, nightmare. It's just a nightmare. And I always feel really bad for the people who are at the end of the conference. And I try to stay and fill seats as best I can. But, you know, you'll notice the end. You know how this works. The end of the day just kind of clears out. Finally, oh no, there's two more things. Number 8, what are the marketing materials you keep talking about that you pack for events and where do you get all of it? I just put a picture up in the hashtag AmWriting Facebook group of my marketing materials. When The Gift of Failure first came out, they offered to make me both bookmarks and postcards. There was a healthy marketing budget for this book, so I took them up on both. And I basically tapped that marketing budget out by ordering as many as I could. I used them constantly. I'm down to my last package of 500 for the Gift of Failure, and I'm going to have to start having them printed myself, which can be expensive. So now I'm being a lot more careful with them. But postcards can be really great. If you don't want someone to forget the title of a book, for example, when I have a copy of The Addiction Inoculation that I'm sending to someone else, I'll slip a postcard for The Gift of Failure inside. So they're reminded, oh, if you like this, here's the other book that she does. I've gone to conferences where I've asked permission to put them on the tables. Often when I'm speaking, I'll go around at the beginning or ask someone to help me out and put a bunch on the tables so that while people are listening to my keynote, they'll have this tangible reminder of what I wrote. And it has the cover of the book. It has blurbs. It has sort of the little short thing on what the book is about. So I have postcards for The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation. I have bookmarks for both The Addiction Inoculation and The Gift of Failure. And The Gift of Failure one I really like because it has 5 takeaways on the back of the bookmark. So that's another really nice utilitarian thing you can give to someone. Here's some real takeaway points to take with you. Take it home, use it as your bookmark, that kind of thing. And then I have my business card. Again, it's in the picture in the Facebook hashtag MWriting group. On the front are the pictures of my books. And on the back is a picture of me with my Instagram handle, my email. I used to not put my email on there because you can get me lots of ways. You can get me through my website, whatever. But I needed to give people my email enough that I got them with my email on it. I do know some people who keep both. They hand out sort of their card with their website and their social handles, and then they reserve one for people that they want to have their email address. That's up to you. I also have a hashtag MWriting card. It's yellow and it has the chicken and the title on the front, and on the back it just says keep your butt in your chair, your butt in the chair and your head in the game, and the Instagram handles for me and KJ and Serena. And this was before Jenny came on with us, so next time I'll add hers on there as well. And then I also, as I mentioned before, had stickers made when the Addiction Inoculation won the media award from the Research Society on Alcohol. It was this very clear front of the book way to make it very clear that the evidence in this book is solid. And I send this book to people who are professionals in the field enough that award is really valuable to me. So I used the logo for the Research Society of America. I put it on, Research Society on Alcohol, and had stickers made. And I had those made at a local Vermont company, and I stick them on the covers of my books before I hand them out. Sometimes I even put them on the Addiction Inoculation postcards. Depends on how many stickers I feel like sticking on things. And that's what I take with me. Okay, finally, number 9, scam alert. I have not written about this in a blog post or anything, but someone else I know did. Jen Mann of the Substack People I Want to Punch in the Throat, a longstanding blog. She's very funny. She wrote a post called I Got Scammed So You Don't Have To that goes a little bit deeper into this scam that I almost got pulled into as well. She did get pulled into it and she wanted to make use of that so that other people didn't fall victim. Lately, I've been receiving a lot of requests for interviews from, quote, producers. It turns out they're not producers. They are always for people with a big following on social media. And they ask, initially they ask about being on the podcast. One just felt kind of odd to me, but I went ahead and I said in my email back, I'm not really clear why this person is interested in my material because doesn't seem to be a great fit. And the quote producer, the alleged producer, wrote back and said, oh, well, this person just likes to interview people who have done interesting things or had an interesting career, whatever. It was vague general language. But then this person said something really interesting. They said something about people who have Facebook who are verified on Facebook and have a professional page and have more than a certain number of followers. I think it was like 5,000, and I have more than that. So that's why and it makes no sense for a producer to reveal that information to me, that I was selected because of my platform, and very specifically the number of followers I have on my Facebook page. So that's when I got suspicious. So I'd gotten a couple of these, and so I decided to take one of them out for a ride and see what happened. So I arranged, they asked for a time to get online and work with me just on prep stuff for an interview, which again is something I hardly ever do. I don't need prep for an interview. And so I'll often email back and say, you know, if you need prep for the interview and you want me to direct you to some resources, I'm happy to do that. But from a tech perspective, whatever, I don't really need to do an introductory call. But I did it with this particular, quote, producer. And when I logged on, the producer did not log on with their face. It was a generic sort of microphone logo. And I knew that this was definitely a scam. And so I was really careful about what I did. And I sort of went through as if I was following their instructions. And essentially what they were trying to get me to do was to change the settings on my professional Facebook page so that eventually, and Jen explains it really well in her I Got Scammed So You Don't Have To post that I've linked in the show notes for this episode. Essentially, people either lose access to Meta completely and are not able to get it back, or in Jen's case and in the case of some other people I've talked to, they were actually selling things through her Meta or through her Facebook page. So yeah, if it sounds fishy, stick with your gut. Yes, it's really tempting to get great exposure, especially when someone is dangling a famous person in front of you. What I ended up doing was I declined. I wrote back to the, quote, producer, and I said, yeah, I don't think this is a great fit. And frankly, I'm really suspicious of your motives. This doesn't feel right to me. And never heard from them again. But I did get in touch with the actual person on the team of this influencer. She's an influencer in finance. And I got in touch with her and I said, just want to let you know, someone using your boss's name has, tried to scam me today and blah, blah, blah. And they were horrified and shocked. And I said, but, you know, while I have you, because this is Jess Leahy here, while I have you, might your boss be interested in reading my book anyway? And they were grateful to me for bringing the point up to them. There's not much they can do about it, really, except for go to their social media channels and say, if you get a request from so-and-so. And the thing was, the email address even looked kind of legit. It was sort of like blah, 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 assistant at gmail.com or blah, 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 podcast booker at gmail.com. So they're really sneaky. Just don't be sucked in. Don't give someone access to your Facebook professional page. Don't give people access to your accounts. And if you read Jen Mann's piece, I Got Scammed So You Don't Have To, just see how clever they were about sucking Jen in. And I'm really grateful to her for writing this piece because it will allow other people to not get sucked in. And as I said, I have received now probably 10 of these scam outreaches. One person told me that they got one of these scam outreaches from, We Can Do Hard Things, Glennon and Abby's podcast. So people are trying it. And if they can get access to your social media channels, they will do it. All right. I hope that answers a bunch of questions for you today. Again, the hashtag AmWriting Facebook group, if you're still on Facebook, and frankly, it is the only reason I'm still on Facebook, it's just a really friendly place to be. It's a lot of very encouraging writers who answer questions for each other. And if you don't understand something that's going on with writing, agenting, editing, whatever the thing is, there's people who respond without judgment and say, oh, this is a great question and this happened to me, let me help you. And there are a lot of friends who have met there too. So, and as I said, we do not allow mean people there. We kick them out if they're mean or if they spam and that kind of thing. So anyway, I hope this has been helpful. Thank you so much for listening, for supporting the podcast, for being a part of this podcast. We do this because we want to flatten the learning curve for other authors. And now that we're at 400 plus episodes, we're just going to keep doing that until you stop listening. So keep listening. If you would like to support the podcast, you can go over to Substack, and there are various ways for you to support the podcast. And we appreciate that. For many years at the beginning of this, we sunk at least $10,000 of our own money into paying a producer and all that sort of stuff. And so really, we want to just be able to keep making this thing. So thanks again, and until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Stop.
Thank you.